I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. Our guest today is Patrick LeBrun. Patrick, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks to be back. Glad to be back.
Great. Well, we're going to talk today about some changes in the Middle East. I was really blackpilled, I have to say, by Trump's Syria strike, like a lot of people were. But since then, things have been changing. I thought the visit to Saudi Arabia also definitely had a rather sinister cast to it. But now Trump is cutting off the Syrian, quote unquote, moderate rebels. And there are a lot of other things in play today. So why don't we turn that over to you, because you have some really interesting ideas on it. So I guess we should begin basically with the narrative of what's been happening, and then we can talk about the significance.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there was an article, I think it was probably the only article worth reading this year in the Washington Post, was about, I think the title was, "Whenever Trump Travels Abroad, Radical Change Follows in His Wake." And I think it's a great image as well, because you imagine, you know, a big boat casts out a wake behind it that shakes all the other smaller boats. And I think that kind of fits with his personal style of what he does. But just to go through, step by step of what happened recently. On May 20th and 21st, Trump visited Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia produced this amazing video. It was like a Bollywood action trailer for a movie of him and his family visiting and dancing around with swords with the Saudi royal family in a very royal welcome for sure. And then on June 5th, there was this major blockade announced against the country of Qatar. If you watch CNN, they'd call it Qatar. If you listen to Hugh Hewitt, the conservative radio host, he calls it Gutter. But this country that's a little peninsula sticking off of Saudi Arabia into the Persian Gulf. And they put forward a series of demands, which are obviously not going to be complied with because they're such intense demands that they made. This happened on June 5th, so just a couple weeks after Trump's visit to Saudi Arabia. And it was led by Saudi Arabia and a few other GCC countries and Egypt. And we'll get into details later onto why this coalition existed. On July 3rd, I think this relates to this as well, Total, the French gas company, announced a major deal with Iran for a gas field that is both in Iranian waters and also in Qatari waters. And then on July 14th was Trump's visit to France. And then about a week later, he announced that he would be ending his support for the anti-Assad groups. And both of these two things that happened within about 5 weeks of each other, I think mark a major, major shift, because as we've covered in previous podcasts, I hear when I talk with you and also on Red Ice Radio, I've really made an effort to outline that the American government doesn't really have its hands dirty necessarily in creating ISIS, but they oversee a process and create a protective umbrella for Gulf donors who funnel money to ISIS, for finding weapons in Libya to purchase to then transfer to Turkey, which are then tunneled in to Syria, whether an actual tunnel or just walked across the border, as it's been filmed, actually. And Israel, of course, has been offering, and they've been bragging about it as a sign of their great humanitarianism, they've been offering medical support to the al-Nusra Front, the al-Qaeda-affiliated group that is near the occupied Golan Heights in that southern part of Syria. So it seems that that protective umbrella has been lifted, and the sign has been sent out that now it's time to get really serious about changing this and bringing an end to the civil war in Syria. The other thing as well is that, and this has been kind of brushed over by a lot of the American foreign policy experts who are speaking about this and demonizing Qatar and Hamas and so on, is that the Obama administration tried to have a rapprochement with the Muslim Brotherhood, to be open to the idea that the Muslim Brotherhood could become a moderate, peaceful, socially conservative political party, if they were given enough carrots to agree to act that way. And that as well was already building on what George W. Bush had already done with Turkey. With the rise of the AKP party, he did not give any support to the secularist, Kemalist, traditional Turks who believe in the nation state, believe in secularism. He did not give them any support in stopping the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood affiliated AKP party, which very recently now has consolidated legislative as well as judicial powers into their president. So Trump has abandoned that policy of making nice with the Muslim Brotherhood. That's quite clear. And I think when we get into more detail on the kinds of relations between the players and how maybe two teams have turned into three teams, we'll clarify that.
Well, let's talk about all the different players just to keep everything straight. I mean, who are the major parties here? There's the Muslim Brotherhood. There's ISIS. Mm-hmm. There's, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the United States.
Yeah.
Also, there's the whole Shiite world. How do they fit into this? And I guess these other sort of quote-unquote moderate groups that were recently cut off in Syria. Mm-hmm. There are just a lot of pieces on the chessboard. So can you sort of distinguish between the various camps here?
Sure. Yeah. So in the big picture between the different camps, we used to talk about the pro-Americans and the anti-Americans. And so, anti-Americans would be Iran, Hezbollah, Syria, and of course, these radical Islamists who are explicitly violent. Now it's turned into, and then you have the pro-American side, Israel, Saudi Arabia, the rest of the GCC, really, the Gulf Cooperation Council, and so on. Now it's become more complicated. You have the Shia side, which would be Iran. It would be Syria, which is ruled by an Alawite family, which actually runs a secular government, unlike Iran and unlike Saudi Arabia, certainly. They're very anti-sectarian. It's a Arab nationalist and social democratic government. Now, when I say social democratic, it doesn't come with all of the guarantees of human rights and good treatment when you're being arrested and so on. But that's the ideology that's running Syria. But it's protected because it's run by a religious minority who are not Sunni. It defends the rest of the religious minorities who together make up about just over 50% of the country from oppression at the hands of Sunnis. You also have the Houthi tribe, which is another sect of Shia Islam, very different from the Twelvers, very different from the Alawites in Syria. And they are fighting a civil war in Yemen right now with Sunnis who are backed by Saudi Arabia. Now, we still have the pro-American camp. We have Israel. We have Saudi Arabia, these other Gulf countries that are allied closer to Saudi Arabia than Qatar is. And then you have this third bloc emerging, which would be Turkey, Qatar, and Muslim Brotherhood affiliated organizations. And to kind of picture in people's minds, and if anyone turns this into a video, hopefully they'll cut in a map maybe or something at this point. But you have, of course, I think everyone knows where Iran and Iraq are, and Saudi Arabia makes up the bulk of the Arabian Peninsula. But if you were going down the Persian Gulf, away from Iraq, down the coast of Saudi Arabia, there's this little island. It's about the size of the city of San Francisco, about the same amount of people, connected to Saudi Arabia by a causeway, and that's Bahrain. And that is a country that's 80% Shia, now very recently it's become 70% Shia, and it's run by a Sunni royal family. Go a bit further down the coast, and then you have a peninsula coming off of Saudi Arabia. And this is Qatar. It's a bit bigger than Bahrain, but it also has very, very few people on it. It's about the number of Qatari nationals is only 250,000. The number of people, though, is much greater. Like other Gulf countries, they have a lot of non-nationals who live there who are not granted citizenship. What makes Qatar kind of have the ability to get a bit more, to play both sides, let's say, in international politics, is that unlike Bahrain, unlike Saudi Arabia, they don't have any Shia population. And they're all Sunni there, the Qatari nationals. And also, they're not Wahhabists. They're not as extreme as the Saudi Arabians. And I think that's partly because of they are the traditional population there. They're like pearl divers, like people in Bahrain. You know, they're not roving across the desert on camels. And so they're much more peaceful people. They're a bit more cosmopolitan than you would find elsewhere in the Arabian Peninsula. Going a bit further down, and again, they have no land border touching. Like, you can go back across Saudi Arabian land again to the south. Then you have the United Arab Emirates, another very wealthy country run by a Sunni monarchy, mostly Sunni, but they have problems with extremists, Sunnis in their country, that causes some certain levels of instability. In fact, some of the 9/11 hijackers were also Emiratis, in addition to all the Saudis. And then you go a bit further down and you have Oman. And Oman is its own sect of Islam, neither Sunni nor Shia. It's the only one in the world, only country in the world with this sect. And unlike the other members of the Gulf Cooperation Council, all these Arabs living along the Persian Gulf, they make about a third the amount as the rest of the people there per year, GDP per capita. So like only 17,000 or so. So again, they don't have the kind of freedom to do what they want because they can't support their people and give them money for nothing, right? So the only one that really has this kind of leeway to act, they can both keep their countrymen very well subsidized, and there's very little source of ethnic or sectarian tension, is Qatar. And so they've really played both sides over the past several years. And also in terms of economic questions, they have other things that have made them independent of Saudi Arabia. The others will act as independent of Saudi Arabia. Qatar has been really independent-minded. So they are the source of Al Jazeera TV, which has really upset the Zionists because they've got on there every week an incredibly popular show with a guy named Yusuf Al-Qaradawi, who's a spiritual advisor, let's say, to the Muslim Brotherhood. Super conservative guy. But at the same time, Al Jazeera has lots of unveiled women all the time doing news. They have women, equality of men and women on the channel, right, doing the work of journalists. They've even covered actually labor disputes in Qatar, reporting negative news about the king of Qatar, as well as negative news about all of the surrounding countries. They just, for the first time in the Arab world, kind of tell it like it is in many ways, and offer a platform for many different voices. And what happened as well that really upset everybody was that they offered a platform to the dissidents in the Arab Spring back in 2011, both the Muslim Brotherhood-style religious conservatives as well as liberal Democrats, social Democrats, to come on and promote change throughout the Arab world. And so this really got under the skin of a lot of the neighboring countries. And then on the economic side, what sets them apart is that they're not an oil-rich country. They're a gas-rich country. And the geopolitical interests of the gas business are very different from those of oil. And Saudi Arabia is as against the development of liquefied natural gas facilities and of pipelines as they are against fracking in North America, because they want to keep selling their cheaply accessible oil in the same low-tech way until it runs out. And so they're kind of at loggerheads when it comes to their own economic interests.
So what exactly were the demands that the Saudis and the others aligned with them placed on Qatar?
So one of them that would be the most it's ridiculous to comply with was shutting down Al Jazeera entirely. Al Jazeera is the number one, and both Al Jazeera English and Al Jazeera Arabic, and that's the number one television station in the Arab world. From Morocco to Maldives, right? I mean, that's like the number one TV station. And so, you know, highly, highly unlikely that that would happen. Another thing is that Turkey announced with Qatar that they would be building a military base. They announced this back in late 2015, early 2016, and it should be completed sometime next year. And the reason that they were going to build it, according to a Turkish general, was to confront common enemies, which is certainly frightening because it's plural enemies, right? So everyone would feel great if it's like, oh, we're here to contain Iran. But because they say common enemies, you know, the Saudis are scratching their head and thinking, well, does that mean us too, right? And, you know, one of the things that, actually, you and I think both have something in common with the Emir of Qatar, and that is that we own the exact same number of tanks. We own zero tanks, right? They have a 20-mile or approximately border with Saudi Arabia, nothing but flat sand stretching out till Doha, and they have no tanks whatsoever. And so, you know, when you think back to the Arab Spring and actually Saudi American tanks that were driven by Saudis into Bahrain quelled the popular revolt against the Sunni monarchy. And, you know, to think that they would hesitate to do the same if things got more heated is a fool's game, really. And so it's very, you know, when you think about it, if Saudi Arabia were to get the green light to act, I think it would be, I mean, Doha could do nothing about it. Qatar could do nothing about it. Now, in terms of other military technology, well, actually, I'll continue with the list of demands.
Where is this military base supposed to be?
In the country, well, it's actually an incredibly small country, so I don't know if it's going to be right on the border or not, actually. And
so it'll be Qatar, though. Okay, that's
the country itself. Yeah, Turkish military base in Qatar, and there's already an American air base in Qatar as well, and it's actually the only country in the region that will allow Americans to land and fly B-52s. So if there was ever to be a quick, big bomb drops, you know, going in on Iran, it would be flown out of Qatar. So that really adds a level of complication to this that that wouldn't be there otherwise. You know, because, of course, you know, I think we all remember that one of the demands that Osama bin Laden made after 9/11 was that they get rid of American military bases in Saudi Arabia. And that's actually a demand that's been conformed with. There are no more military bases in Saudi Arabia. There's a naval base in Bahrain. There's the air base in Qatar. But there is no more military U.S. military installation in Saudi Arabia. And so that, that adds a big, big level of complication to resolving this this issue. So the other big thing about, you know, in addition to the Turkish airbase and Al Jazeera, is that they want Qatar to be to stop supporting the Muslim Brotherhood in general, and also to end all of their friendly ties with Iran. And so Qatar is, like I said, a major gas power. And they have been, they actually are the number one in the world for liquefied natural gas, which means that it's really hard to get gas from one place to another because either you need a pipeline or you need to cool it down and turn it into liquid to move it in bulk from one place to another. It's not, you know, like oil where you just pour it from one container to another. And so they did a lot to develop this technology when it was quite new. They didn't want to flood the market, and also they were getting blocked by Saudi Arabia when it came to building connections with their neighbors. There's a lot of pressure about, you know, they wanted to build a bridge to Bahrain. That was, you know, shut down by Saudi Arabia. They wanted to have a pipeline going to the United Arab Emirates. That was shut down by Saudi Arabia. And they also had one that they had already agreed to and already started work on with Kuwait. Actually, I skipped Kuwait when I was doing that, going down the list of Gulf states. Kuwait, of course, is between Saudi Arabia and Iraq. They shut down the planned pipeline with Kuwait. And so, you know, this was a – so they put it basically in place to cool things down with Saudi Arabia and also to wait for the market conditions to get better, a 12-year moratorium on natural gas exploitation. And also their gas field is basically on the maritime border between them and Iran. And Iran as well was saying, you know, cool it with developing the stuff because they were probably tapping into Iranian gas as well. So now they announced in April, Qatar announced that, okay, the moratorium is over. We're going to start developing this. And in, when was it? July 3rd, Total, the French gas company, announced a $5 billion gas deal with Iran. And so the feeling is that this is in cooperation with Qatar. Qatar and Iran are working together on this thing with Total. And so they don't, they don't want them to have the economic independence. They don't want them to develop this technology. They are really going to sell, and also they won't be as dependent on the same relationships as Saudi Arabia is to sell their gas, their oil. Saudi Arabia mostly sells to Europe. This liquefied natural gas will largely go to East Asia, to China and to Japan. And so, you know, they're really parting ways in terms of where their interests lie and how they protect their own interests. And Qatar obviously saw this coming as well, because if you look at other military technology that they have, you know, they just participated in the recent deal for F-15s when they were released. But what they're flying now is almost entirely French airplanes, the Rafale, right, and things made by Dassault Systems. And so, you know, anyone who wanted to have a non-aligned foreign policy in the past would, you know, refuse to fly MiGs and refuse to fly F-15s or whatever, you know, other thing was being made in America. They would fly French planes, and so they wouldn't be afraid of running out of parts like Iran did in the Iran-Iraq War. They ran out of tank parts and helicopter parts because they depended on their relationship with America. Argentina, for example, right, when they had their dispute over the Falklands Islands with Britain, they were flying French fighter jets at that time. So, you know, they definitely have been prepared long term for a kind of third way approach to their foreign policy. And their end game is kind of, you know, everyone's left wondering what it really is. You know, because they have a relationship with Iran that's, you know, the economic support or cooperation. They have supported ISIS. They've supported Muslim Brotherhood. They've also done liberalizing things, you know, through Al Jazeera and other ways. They've actually, you know, women have been voting there, I think, maybe longer than any other Gulf country since 1999. They've been voting in municipal elections. Female, I don't know what you would call her, but a female member of the royal family who does a lot of public interactions. Her name's Sheikha Moza. You know, she doesn't really cover all of her hair. You know, she dresses kind of in a modern way, which, you know, definitely, like, in these kind of societies, kind of sends, it's like she's a tastemaker, right? She's kind of setting the standard for others to follow. You know, the king of, or the emir of Qatar, his style is really like a European monarch. When you see him in interviews and chatting, his own, he often wears a suit and just a mustache, and the way he talks is more like, you know, he was educated at Sandhurst. He was more like a European monarch. Compare that to, you know, Saudi Arabia. It's like, who, you know, find a picture of the wife of the king, you know, good luck, you know. Even in, like, regular society, like, asking someone the name of their mother is considered like an impolite thing. You know, they can't even say the name of their mother in public. Of course, like, if you watch the royal family of Saudi Arabia in interviews, it's like these, you know, bizarre, senile, drug crazed Bedouins. You know, it's like not like a European monarch, right? That's kind of, I hope I'm these things are coherent. I'm kind of throwing out a lot at once.
No, this is all very interesting. I kind of feel more sympathetic to Qatar now, honestly.
Yeah.
Whereas before, I just associated them with support for really backwards forces, very much in line with American and Saudi policy. And that includes groups like the Muslim Brotherhood and ISIS and so forth. To hear that they have their own kind of third way agenda, that makes me a little more sympathetic to them. Also, the fact that they do keep Al Jazeera up and running, and it's clearly a destabilizing force in that region.
It's
very interesting. Whatever the long game, if there is a long game of these of the Qatari royals, I think they're hoping to bob to the top. If some great flood, some great political deluge engulfs the Arab Peninsula.
Right. Yeah, if there's like an 1848 style, like, you know what I mean, or something like this, where the Muslim Brotherhood was the galvanizing force, Qatar would be safe. The other Gulf monarchs would not be safe, right?
Right. Do you think they're just playing dynastic politics? They're like playing both sides to try and basically, keep their perks and titles and stuff like that? Is it that petty, or could there be something bigger?
I mean, honestly, it's there's no way to know. Honestly, I really wish.
It is shocking. It is shocking to me, really, how petty a lot of the court politics are of these various Arab states. And so, it wouldn't entirely surprise me if that were the case. How petty and dumb! But they're not very bright people, generally, and they're backwards, primitive people, and their average intelligence isn't that high, and even the elites have so much first cousin marriage and inbreeding depression that even the elites aren't all that select. So
I think that they're far more clever than they're often given credit for. But first, about playing both sides again, one thing I forgot to mention. I mean, at the same time that they're having a thaw with Iran, and obviously having behind closed doors, not announced to the public, agreements on how to exploit gas in the Persian Gulf, they had troops in Yemen fighting against the Houthis, who are supported by Iran. They participated alongside their soldiers, were standing shoulder to shoulder with those of Saudi Arabia in Yemen. And it didn't stop until the day that these demands were given to Qatar. And I should mention also, at the same time, to give you a sense of the intensity of the pressure, not only were diplomats recalled, as they had been in the past from Saudi Arabia over other small business disputes, they also closed the land border, and they closed the use of all airspace to Qatar Airlines and, of course, to their military. They gave Qatari nationals, I think, a month to move out of their countries if they were living there. And to the diplomatic staff and governmental staff, I think it was 48 hours. Now, in Qatar, 1% of their food is made locally. 80% of it goes across the border with Saudi Arabia. And they don't have deep water harbors, so they can't take in super tankers unloading massive amounts of cargo. And so they were actually flying in on Turkish airlines, commercial Turkish airlines were being filled with milk and baby formula, right? Flown into Qatar, and then this was broadcast on Al Jazeera, and they were, of course, they also got aid from Iran, and they were rerouting planes through Iran and through Iraq. And in terms of the propaganda war, I think with the average Arab public, they thought that they had a lot of sympathy for the Qataris, and they have gone well beyond the date of this shutting down. And in the meantime, they closed a deal with Italy to purchase naval – I didn't get specifics on what actual material it was, but military naval ships they purchased from Italy. And so they demonstrated an ability to survive this level of economic pressure and sanctions and closed borders and isolation. The only next step for Saudi Arabia to not look like they are totally impotent is military intervention. And I think their military intervention would be a lot easier in Qatar than it is in Yemen. But in Yemen, I mean, they're throwing the best of American technology, or maybe I should say the best of 10 years ago American technology, throwing that at these mountain tribesmen living in caves, and they're failing. They've killed 10,000 civilians, it's estimated, and they're failing. And so, they look totally impotent in the region. And so, and also, to the more and more, it looks like in the region, the ability of the kind of American Zionist alliance to force certain political settlements is also disappearing. So it's a, and I should say as well, Egypt is deeply involved in this. Egypt was part of those who sent the demands because it's run by the military dictatorship that displaced the Muslim Brotherhood and is really teetering on failure. And maybe it just is worth going into another thing more in depth about Saudi Arabian politics, but they actually signed over a couple islands in the Red Sea to be to no longer be part of Egypt, to now be part of Saudi Arabia. Islands which many Egyptian soldiers died in the 67 war with Israel to secure. And so they had to do this in exchange for the billions of dollars in aid that they got, not to solve problems at their root, but essentially to put band-aids on problems in the country, you know, in keeping the economy afloat. Keeping people with enough bread on their table to not revolt, basically.
So where does Trump fit into all of this? Do you think Trump might have given the green light for this pressure on Qatar?
I think so. I think that the main issue, and maybe if, you know, of these 13 demands, the only one that they eventually follow is to stop giving money to these extremists and actually to kind of crack down on members of the royal family. Because this is the other problem with these monarchies, is that you've got, I think, 6,000 members of the Al Saud family, 6,000 princes of the blood. In Qatar, you have 2,000 princes of the blood. They're all sitting on immense wealth, and you have this wide range of attitudes between them. And you have some of them who are definitely on the jihadist, Salafist side of things. And they are giving money to fund extremist violence, whether it's terrorism that reaches Europe or North America, whether it's trying to develop this state in Syria through guerrilla warfare. They are sending their money to do that, and the culture of the Arab world in general, but even more so of the Arabian Peninsula, is that it's really when they family first. For real, you never have a situation where if somebody finds out their cousin or brother or whatever committed a horrific crime that they call the cops on them, right? They really will not. I heard someone make this comparison at a recent think tank conference. He said that expecting the Qatari royal family to start arresting people over terrorist funding is like expecting Trump to arrest Kushner for doing something wrong, it's just not the way they operate over there. But maybe this would really kind of, there will be no punishments, but there will be no transgressions going forward, right? that's kind of the Arab way when it comes to these family politics, let's say. Which is a good thing, which is a very good thing, I think, for us.
Yeah, that is a good thing. I would definitely like to see less aid to things like the Muslim Brotherhood and ISIS and these other groups. And do you think this is connected with Trump defunding the CIA-backed, quote-unquote, moderate rebels, these cannibals and head choppers in Syria?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think only Haaretz, of all the headlines that I saw, only they even had the temerity to still use the word moderate rebels when they wrote the headline about it. Not even the Washington Post would put that in the headline. I think these are absolutely connected. I think it's an about face, essentially. And the thing is, like, Saudi Arabia already did an about face once because they were very anti-Muslim Brotherhood under the previous king. Under the current king, about 6 months in, they had a change of policy, which was in line with Obama. And now we see them taking this hard line and, back again in their other direction. And also it's, of course, I think everyone around the world is saying, like, okay, Saudi Arabia is, like, wagging their finger at Qatar about funding extremists. Like, really? Like,
do they really want to go there? Yeah.
Yeah, the pot calling the kettle black. But it's once again, like, it's kind of people like to say this about – diplomacy or business in Asia is that it's all about saving face. I think it's the same way everywhere. Everyone wants to save face. And that's what this is about. It's that, you know, Saudi Arabia needs America to stay afloat, frankly. Like, if without America, the royal family would all be living off of their savings on the Riviera, you know.
Or they'd be, you know, a pile of corpses after some Baathist-type colonel's coup.
That would be, yeah, that would be the other. Well, actually, you know, the thing is, they're one of the reasons why their military is so ineffective is that
they're afraid of their own military. Yeah.
Well, their senior officers are all family members.
Oh, okay.
And so it's like, you know, if you're a multimillionaire from birth, you're not going to risk your life to keep your great uncle a billionaire. And so, you know, the command leadership is just pathetic, you know. And I've seen videos actually from Yemen where they show, you know, the normally you have tanks and infantry moving together, right? And that's actually more safe to do so because then you can defend your tanks against, you know, others in the caves and the mountains and so on taking pot shots at them. But mentally speaking, right, standing outside in the sun, exposed to bullets, you know, your gut reaction is to feel like you're more in danger. And what do? They send out their tanks all by themselves with no one around them, you know, on foot or in any other kind of vehicle. And they get picked off so easily. So these multi-million dollar tanks where their entire crews are being blown up by guys with $5,000 rocket-propelled grenades. And that's because, and the reason is, you know, why is that? Well, because they don't have a military culture where leaders are willing to take risk with their men. And so the men end up being just as cowardly and weak as their leaders. And so, yes, I mean, they're we can't expect them to do anything serious against someone who is fighting for their livelihood and for their tribe, as opposed to, say, the Qatari military, which is probably not so different from the Saudi military. It's going to, you know, they're just going to throw more materiel at them and probably win very quickly.
Right. They'll fire their guns in the air and then run away.
Yeah. But I think that it's probably all. I think both things are a good thing. One is that you know, Saudi Arabia has saved face and will going forward not fund these guys that in Syria that we don't like. Qatar will probably do the same. And at the same time, Saudi Arabia is also looking very weak, even though, you know, as weak as ever, certainly maybe at their weakest even, because they're not able to project power and they're not able to force others to comply with their demands. And so a weaker Saudi Arabia, a weaker, you know, violent jihadist movements, these are both good things. And the only bad thing is that Turkey is emerging as a regional power. And Turkey is still a NATO member. And so as a NATO member, it's very hard to keep them in check.
Right.
Yeah. And then I guess the other thing would be, you know, a stronger Iran and their proxies would help keep in check the Zionist-Salafist alliance, which is, I mean, my God, this is what could be worse? Zionist being the leaders of the region.
Yeah, that sounds pretty horrible to me. Yeah, what I would like to see is I'd like to see more of these. There really are moderate Muslims. There are people like Saddam Hussein and the Supreme Military Council of Egypt and the Assad family. These are the moderate Muslims. I'd like to Gaddafi. I'd like to see more people like them. I'd like to see fewer people like these sheikhs and emirs and kings, especially if they are aligned with extremist forms of Islam. the more pro-Western and secular the kings, the better. I thought the Shah of Iran wasn't a bad model, honestly.
Yeah, so Oman is sitting it out, and I think because they can't project, they can't rock the boat as much because of their because they're not an oil or gas power. They only make 17,000 per capita in GDP, and they're only outside of this Sunni Shia sectarian divide. Then and also Kuwait sat it out, and I think that the reason they sat it out was probably to play the part of a neutral negotiator, when in fact they're on the Saudi side. The other possibility, or maybe it's both, is that just the governmental structure in Kuwait there's more consultation and there's more divided power, and so it takes them a bit longer to make these kinds of decisions. So if they were throwing this together in the 2 weeks that followed President Trump's visit, Kuwait is not as agile to jump in on it and get everything greenlit, give the green light to every one of these points and give input and so on.
Right.
But the other thing is, too, and this is where I think it's both a reflection of the innate paranoia, but also the innate cleverness of the Arab mind. And that is that, so if I wanted to give $4,999 to a terrorist organization, which I don't, just in case anybody's listening, that would be below the threshold for sending up flags by the Patriot Act. It could probably be done relatively easily. You get it to some other legit business or charity near the target area, and then it's cashed out or it's put into some kind of liquid asset to be transferred to them, right? Now, if I wanted to give in the millions, it'd be harder. If I wanted to give $100 million, it would be exceedingly difficult. Now, this is what, and I this is the rumor that I've heard. I don't think I've seen anything written about it. I haven't tried to look very hard, but I believe that the Saudis believe that the Qataris intentionally gave $100 million to ISIS. And here's how it happened. The members of the Qatari royal family went on a hunting expedition. They were kidnapped by ISIS-affiliated militants. And in order to get them released, they had to pay a $100 million ransom. Now, was this a legit kidnapping in which they had to give this amount of money, which is something that any, clannish Gulf Arab could understand and be like, yeah, of course, you got to pay up to get your family back? Or was it some kind of trick? Was it actually just a big fake ruse in order to transfer this much money without getting, your banks shut down from the SWIFT system, without getting brought before the UN for, funding ISIS and so on and so forth, right? This is what my understanding is that the Saudis believe that's what was really going on. And once again, it's like, with so often with these kind of things, you kind of may never know the truth behind it. But that's one of the things driving this.
That's really interesting. So what do you think this all bodes for Trump's foreign policy, American foreign policy in the future? What kind of moves do you expect out of Trump? What kind of agenda do you think this reveals?
I think it is revealing the kind of America first foreign policy that he had talked about in his campaign. This is something that doesn't entail further American intervention. And it also is something that, for a guy who lost, as he said, hundreds of friends in 9/11, it's refocusing on what should be the first objective. And that is to fight this Salafist, Wahhabist Islam until it's gone. And instead what America's been doing, the American government's been doing since 9/11, has been following either the neocon blueprint for massive regime change in the Middle East, which largely benefits Israel more than the United States. Or it's been following the Zbigniew-Brzezinski grand chessboard approach, which is let's foment sectarian tension and have Shias and Sunnis fighting each other rather than the Sunnis coming and fighting us, and rather than the Shias projecting power further out, they'll be focused on their own local problems. So that's all very clever and, you know, and may work, but it also, just as Zbigniew-Brzezinski's previous plan of funding the Taliban and the Mujahideen, who became the Taliban, I should say, in Afghanistan, may also entail a great deal of blowback. And frankly, France, more than any other country, has been facing that blowback, as well as the party boys of Orlando, as well as the health and safety departments in San Bernardino, as well as, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, right, exactly. It does look like Trump is getting things back to what we elected him to do, in other words.
Yeah, yeah. I think so. I think I do think it's reason to be pleased with what he's done. And once again, I think it's always – I think it's going to be the story of the next 3.5 years, if not 7.5 years, is that everything is going to take time and everything is going to require other people who are powerful signing on and benefiting. Right. Right? In this case, Saudi Arabia, we don't like them too much, and I think – we can say unequivocally, you know, I don't like reading the minds of politicians and certainly don't make the assumption of what they say is what they think. But I think we are safe to say Trump does not like Saudi Arabia. And yet he's doing something that really benefits Saudi Arabia here. But in the long run is moving us in the right direction.
It benefits us more. And honestly, you know, one of the definitions of, well, one of the characteristics of spite that makes it such a dangerous emotion is you end up hating your enemies more than you love yourself. So if you really, really hate Saudi Arabia, you might not be able to actually do a deal with them that would help Americans. And I think that Trump is more mature than that. So I think that he has a disdain for these people. I mean, anyone would. And anyone who knew anything about the background of 9/11 and just what goes on in that kingdom would have a disdain for them. But if he can pressure them to stop certain things that are bad for America, he's going to make it worth their while. That's just the way he is. You win by having more people agree with you and fewer people fighting against you. And I think that he understands that instinctively. And that means I think that he's going to have a much less confrontational foreign policy than I feared, and that he's sort of caricatured as wanting. Maybe there's at least 3D chess going on here. Maybe we need to give him a little more credit than we have recently.
I think the meme is real. He's a master negotiator. He does play 3D or 5D or whatever, D chess. Also, I guess to bring it up to another level as well, you know, if there are continued tensions in the region, which there are, right? This, the failure to comply, the fact that there were demands put forward and demands that were not met, and division amongst the GCC countries will raise tensions. And when there are raised tensions there, just by the force of speculation, the price of oil goes up. So the OECD countries, or I should say the European members of the OECD countries, use the exact same amount of oil and gas, or definitely oil, I think gas as well, as they did in the year 2000. And if you look at changes in price, the correlation between change in price and change in GDP in Europe is about zero. The United States is a little bit more sensitive than they are. But who's really sensitive? All of the developing world, especially China. So, you know, we basically, for the American point of view on foreign policy, is that there's this fear of Russia, Iran, and China either making a deal or rising in power. For the past few years, China's had a much better go at it based on these changes in commodities prices, and Russia has been weakened by it. Iran has been weakened by it. The sanctions plus the drop in oil actually has had a massive effect on the purchasing power of your average Iranian, and of course weakens the regime as a result. The change in the price will mean a stronger Russia, the Russia which is dedicated 7 days a week to stopping Islamic extremism, as opposed to the American military, which is kind of not so sure, right? And it also weakens China, which I think, you know, if we listen to how many times he said the word China in the beginning of his campaign, we know he's much more concerned about the rise of China than Russia or Iran.
It also helps American oil producers as well when prices go up. More people are working in American oil fields. And honestly, higher oil prices force Americans to innovate, which is a pressure that we want to always have in our economy. Cheap natural resources leads to laziness and low tech, and we don't want to be lazy and low tech. So.
Absolutely. There are two last things maybe we can cover before we wrap up. One is about Hamas, and one would be about the legend of the Al Thani family, the royal family of Qatar. So one of the things that happened with Hamas is their headquarters in exile previously had been in Damascus, which means that this was a Iranian-supported operation, right? Now, Hamas is its roots are in the Muslim Brotherhood. They split away from them many, many years ago. It's Sunni as well. Iran is backing them, not out of sectarian preference, but because they are the last fighting force in Israel that is has massive public support. The PLO is no longer serious about defending Palestinian sovereignty, right? Or about they've come to an agreement that has basically de-radicalized them, essentially. Hamas has not. Now, when the civil war heated up in Syria, they actually left their offices in Damascus and they set up shop in Doha, Qatar. And that actually not only did it upset Israel, it also upset Iran at the time. And that's because Iran lost their leverage over Hamas. It no longer became an extension of Iranian foreign policy. It became a much more independent national liberation Islamist movement. Now, one of the demands of these 13 was that Hamas is no longer welcome in Qatar, which has really made me, you know, think like, okay, you know, there's an AIPAC in America that fights for Israeli interests. Is there an AIPAC in Saudi Arabia as well that is fighting for them? Because why the hell does Saudi Arabia care that Hamas is present in Qatar, that they're allowed to fly in and out, that they're allowed to have offices and raise money from there? But that was one of their demands.
If Trump is engineering this, that makes a little bit of sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. You're right. Now, the other thing about the Al Thani family and maybe their possible endgame, they're mentioned twice, actually, their family in the Hadith. One of them, the Hadith is like the sayings of Muhammad. These are the after the Quran, which is supposedly dictated by God. There are these sayings that were collected over the course of about 200 years of the companions and people who listened to what the companion said, Muhammad said, right? And one thing that was mentioned about them, now they're not from the Quraysh tribe, which means that they cannot be, they're not candidates for the Mahdi, right? This kind of end times leader who will lead all the Muslim people. However, they're mentioned two places. One place was a poem that was recited by one of the other followers of Muhammad, insulting them for their low birth and their kind of being, you know, recent arrivals to the leadership in the Arab world. The other mention is that Muhammad said to somebody that their family would be the most important and the most strident in fighting against Dajjal, which is the Islamic version of Antichrist, in the end times. So, you know, whether they believe that or not, they have it in the back of their minds that when things get heated and when people are in a more of an apocalyptic fervor, they've got that, you know, ace up their sleeve, that everyone will be able to go back and point to that and say, see, we are the one standing up against the Dajjal more than anybody else. And so you should be sympathetic with us and not these others. So that's, I don't know what to say, about it, but it's a weird, one of the weird quirks of the Muslim world. And the role that these kind of apocalyptic predictions and hadith have.
That's fascinating. Well, you know, this stuff does influence politics all the time. So,
Yeah. Exactly.
There. It is conceivable that there is a correlation of forces in the world where suddenly the Qatari royal family seems anointed to perform some very important function in the minds of Muslims. So,
yeah.
And I guess they're acting like it's already true.
Yeah,
they're trying to meme it into reality, perhaps, which is pretty fascinating.
It does, yeah.
Well, this has been great. We've been going at it for an hour or so, and I think we are going to reach soon the outer limits of people's attention spans. So let's pause this, and we'll keep watching the region, and we'll definitely have you come back on again very soon.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.